will likely look very different from how it was approached in Atlanta.
There is no Cop City model. There's no Atlanta model. If anything,
hey, what's up? This is Ronnie Ma, and I'm a radio intern for WRFU, LP, Urbana 104.5 FM. Thank you for listening, and keep it tuned.
Poem by an animal in the Willani Forest. Posted on May 21st, 2022. Willani Forest.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WRFU, the Independent Media Center, or the Socialist Forum.
This is WRFU, Radio Free Urbana.
What I have learned as a student and as a teacher is that whoever we are, wherever we are, however comfortable we feel in our skins and within our ideas and our communities, we can never stop asking questions about those things we most take for granted.
That was Angela Davis, activist, author, and distinguished professor emerita in the history of consciousness and feminist studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. On this week's episode of Education Justice Radio, we listened to Professor Davis' talk, Abolishing the Prison Industrial Complex, which she gave as part of the lecture fall series, Rethinking Security Beyond Mass Incarceration, on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Also listened to responses she gave at a breakfast meeting at the Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana. Both events took place in September 2013. We will hear also the one time Professor Davis mentioned my name. It was, of course, not about me, but about the Education Justice Project, which Professor Davis took as one example for initiatives around the country that take education as a key tool to work within and against the ramifications of the prison industrial complex. We would like to thank our EJP students at Danville Correctional Center for their valuable critical feedback on the work of Angela Davis that we included in the discussion with Professor Davis.
The mid-90s, towards the end of the 90s, a group of us got together in the San Francisco Bay Area and try to figure out how we could transform the way people were thinking about what we perceived to be a growing crisis of incarceration. And that time there were, I don't know, I can't remember exactly, but maybe there were a million people in prison. I know we mourn the fact that there were a million people behind bars, and now there are about 2.5 million, as you know. And so we thought about how that might be possible. And Mike Davis, who is an activist and an academic, had written about the transformation of California's economy, the move from an agricultural economy, particularly in the central California, to what he called a prison industrial complex. So we took that term, prison industrial complex, and decided that we would try to popularize it. And perhaps that would allow people to think about issues like racism, to think about issues like profit in relation to imprisonment and not focus so myopically on crime. And we were shocked. We decided to hold this conference around this time in 1998, September, I think it was, it may have been the same weekend. And we called it Critical Resistance Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex. And we were hoping that a few hundred people would show up, because there weren't very many connections with people doing this work all over the country and in other parts of the world. And we organized this conference again with like no staff, no paid staff. It was all volunteer work. It was activists, it was former prisoners, it was people who were in prison, who helped to get the word out. And 3,500 people showed up.
Yeah.
And that was so amazing. And from all over the country, and even Australia and Europe. And so that was a sign to us that people needed to feel connected, because there were so many people either doing the work or interested in the work. And so it's so fulfilling to see that however many years later, this is 1998 to 2013, that there are people who are continuing. And I see that your slogan is build programs, not jails. And I think that is the key. If one looks at the history of the system of incarceration used in this country and all over the world for punishment, one sees that since the very beginning, there have been those who spoke out against the use of imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment. There have been, you know, as many people have noticed, the whole history of the prison system has been a history of struggles against imprisonment, the history of prison reform. And one of the problems is that as much as people have been morally opposed to the horrors that are associated with imprisonment, they haven't necessarily added the piece about building alternatives and building programs. And not so much alternatives within the criminal justice system, but alternatives such as educational alternatives, recreation, all of the things that would tend to make imprisonment obsolete, as I wrote this little book that's called Are Prisons Obsolete?
You think you got it all set up. You think you got the perfect plan to charm every girl you see and play with everyone that you can. But I've got news for you. I hope it won't hit you too hard. One of these days, while you're at play, I'm gonna catch you off guard. I'm gonna tear down. Pretty soon, I'm gonna tear your playhouse down. Room by room. Yeah. just fun and games, trying to be a playboy. All you do is run around using hearts for play toys. You've been playing daddy with every mama around. What you gonna say when you look up one day, see your playhouse tumbling down?
There's this wonderful program that Dave Vertigo was telling me about last night, and Mandy mentioned it during our meeting today, which is education justice. And that many people who actually go in to teach prisoners at Stanford think that they're going in to, you know, help the poor prisoners. And in the process, they themselves are transformed in ways they could not have possibly imagined. We cannot assume a distance or a hierarchy that defines people inside and outside prisons. The relations must be egalitarian. People inside help us theorize and struggle around issues related to people in prison, but more importantly, these issues belong to every agenda that purports to be about social justice.
And yeah, I can understand why somebody who did something really, really horrible would say, oh, I belong here. Because there's nothing else. Because we're not accustomed to try to figure out why it is that people do such terrible things. And it's not only that the whole prison system devours so much talent from our communities, destroys our communities, which it does. It's also that it serves as an excuse for our failure to address violence, for example. Our knee-jerk response is just put them in prison. And then we don't have to think about it. And so I'm not suggesting that nothing should be done. And certainly people who've experienced harm inflicted by others have to have some recourse. But the work that's been done on restorative justice is so promising. And actually even with respect to the most horrible kinds of harm. There have been people who have reconciled. My sister works with an organization called Restorative Justice for Oakland U. And they go into the schools to try to teach kids how to solve their problems without resorting to violence. And I think we have to do something like that. It's not as if we can be content with the kind of society we live in and say, oh, the only problem is that we have too many prisons, so we need to get rid of the prisons and everything will be okay. We have to transform the society and figure out how to eradicate violence. Violence against women. It just doesn't help to just keep sending perpetrators of violence against women into prison, because if you look at the statistics, since the criminalization of domestic violence and the incarceration of many people around the world and the development of all of these other programs with respect to violence against women, and I mean, people have done amazing work. I've been involved in that work as well. But the fact is that the incidence of violence against women has not changed. So obviously, is wrong with the assumption that criminalization is the answer. So I think it's just, this is just the beginning of a conversation. So how do you figure out why people engage in, you know, terrible violence against children and sexual molestation of children? And most of the time, we don't want to think about that. It's so horrible, we don't even want to hold that in our minds. And so the prisons allows us to extricate ourselves from that. We simply say, oh, put the perpetrators in prison. But then it keeps happening. And oftentimes it's cyclical. And there are no ways to address it. There's an organization called Generation 5. And they consist of abusers and people who've been abused. So in order to be in that organization, you either have to have been abused or you have to be an abuser yourself. And their idea is that it is going to take 5 generations to get rid of that kind of abuse. And they have this strategy of what people do in the first generation, and what the second generation does, and what the third generation does, and the fourth generation. So we have to have a perspective that is much longer than our own lives. We have to get rid of this idea that all problems should have instantaneous solutions. And that is what prisons are. It's an instant solution. And it prevents you from actually thinking deeply about how to solve these problems. So that is what I would tell the other group, that thinks prisons should continue to exist.
I'm sure you won't be able to turn your head away. Cause what I'm gonna talk about, nobody, nobody, nobody wants to be without. Makes no difference who you are or what color you happen to be. As long as you're alive and breathing, this has got to be one of your needs. I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about freedom, yeah. I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about freedom, y'all. Freedom for you and me. And every living thing that breathes. When you see how free the birds fly in the sky, you're gonna have to say, my, oh my, oh my, oh my. And all of the water that's in the sea, oh, how it flows so very free. Makes no difference who you are or what color you happen to be. I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about freedom. Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if everybody could feel free. Freedom for you and me. your daddy, your little sister, freedom to do as I choose to do. Come on now, give me some freedom. I want some freedom. Come on, come on, come on, give me some freedom, y'all. Give me some freedom. Freedom, 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 freedom.
I think that in general, we project too much of our own potential power onto the people we elect. And especially when you elect someone like Barack Obama and you have someone like Eric Holder as Attorney General, we assume that they should be the ones doing the work. Whereas we really know that the only way they can do the work is if we push them to do it. So I think that the steps that have been taken recently, and of course, you know, we've been talking about the extent to which the so-called war on drugs fuels over-incarceration since the 1980s, and even before that, but especially the so-called drug wars of the 1980s. You know, we've known about the crack disparity, crack cocaine disparity, and we've known about the fact that it's not just the drug wars, but it's racism that is behind, that fuels the prison industrial complex. And that, as a matter of fact, white people do drugs and traffic in drugs as much or more than people of color. But if you look at the people who are arrested, well, first of all, if you look at the people who are surveilled, because it really is about racist surveillance. Yeah. It's about who gets caught because they happen to be in places that are saturated with the police. And it's just so amazing that it takes so long to get such a simple point across. And so it's not just about reducing the imprisoned population, it's about challenging racism. This is the 50th anniversary of a lot of major moments in the civil rights movement. You know, I just did an event on September 15th observing the 50th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And then, of course, there was the march on Washington. And so everybody celebrated this 50th anniversary, and some people are celebrating it as if it was just a thing of the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank God that we've gone beyond. We're not where we were 50 years ago. And it's true, we aren't where we were 50 years ago. Some things are much better, but a lot of things are much worse. And it is, I think, because we haven't learned how to talk about structural racism. So racism is still perceived to be overt segregation, overt discrimination by law. It's that on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's about people's attitudes. But we don't have the kind of vocabulary that will allow us to talk about structural racism. And one of the things that I'll say is, one of the things that was one of the positive developments in relation to the fact that George Zimmerman wasn't convicted, and I say in relationship to that because I know people all over the country were so upset, and with every right. But had he been convicted and sent to prison, that would have closed the book. It would have, yes, it would have ended the conversation. And the assumption is that you deal with racism by addressing individuals. And with that, we will never be able to root out the entrenched, structural, institutional racism that is responsible for so much damage today. So, yes, insist that we talk about racism. And it's not just this accidental racial disparity.
Because I'm black. Oh, somebody tell me, what can I do? Will I survive or will I die? Bobby say one time, you can make it if you try. Oh, and some of us, we're trying so hard. We're trying so hard. I want you to know that I don't speak for myself, but I speak for y'all too right now. You see, if you have white, light brown skin, and a high yellow, you're still black. So we all got to stick together right now. This I want to say to you, my sisters and my brothers. Right on, sister. Right on, brother. Dig this. If we keep on pushing, y'all, oh, we got to make it a little bit further. We got to make it a little further. All we got to do is try, try, try. And some of us, we're trying so hard. We're trying so hard. We're trying so hard. We're trying so hard to be somebody. We're trying so hard, although they're holding us back. And it stands to reason that they're doing us like that. You know what? It is. I believe it's because we're black. But hey, we can't stop now. We can't stop now. We got to keep on, keep on, keep on, keeping on. We got to keep on, keeping on. I know and I know and I know that you know that I know it ain't right. Oh, it ain't right. It ain't right. It ain't right. That they hold us, hold us, hold us back. They're holding us back. They're holding us back. I wonder. Sometimes I sit down and I wonder.
The abolitionist movement, the anti-prison movement, with which many of us identify, is rapidly growing in strength and influence. I can remember when those of us who called ourselves prison abolitionists were considered to be absolutely out of our minds. Crazy radicals. It used to be the case that we had to struggle to get people to understand the importance of this movement and its connections to a whole range of social justice issues. And many people were so influenced by dominant ideologies that they could not possibly understand what they had in common with people who were spending so many years of their lives behind bars. And of course, today, many more people recognize that connection. We see the increasing profitability of imprisonment. This is why we began to actually use the term prison industrial complex, because we wanted to encourage people to think about other reasons why there's so many people in prison. And so we began to use some different terms. We began to talk about mass incarceration. We also used the term prison nation to describe the U.S., which represents itself as a model for democracy in the world. And if you want to ask, well, what kind of democracy? A democracy that has proportionally more people in prison than any other country. A country that has 25% of the entire globe's in prison population, but 5% of the population as large. And so we need a vocabulary that reflects this, that also addresses the extent to which the economy is so deeply invested in a continuation of a system of imprisonment that is driven by racism and that has its roots in the history of slavery. We need a vocabulary and analysis that allows us to understand the relationship between the prison crisis and violence against women. And I'll say that when we speak about violence that that happens at the hands of public officials or wannabe police, we usually think about young men. And of course, the Trayvon Martin case is something that all of us have felt so deeply connected to. But the point that I wanted to make is that actually, if you look at who the victims of violence are in this country and in the world, it's women. And we don't make that connection. So as important as it is to build the kinds of movements around the Trayvon Martin case and Oscar Grant and so forth, it's... And then, of course, there was Peggy Pendleton in Chicago. But this connection between the violence that happens behind closed doors. Intimate violence, domestic violence. This is what anti-racist feminists have contributed to our analysis of the prison industrial complex and to abolition. Because early on, when people first began to talk about abolishing imprisonment, and I'm talking about the 70s, it wasn't the first time, but in the aftermath of Attica, there was a major discourse about prison abolition. But this was also when the women's movement was developing, and we were first learning how to talk politically about violence against women. And so there were some people who were saying, well, you want to abolish prisons? Precisely at the time when we figured out that we have to do something to hold all of these people accountable for committing violence against women. So that was a moment that was an important moment, but a moment that contained many, many contradictions. And again, I wish I could continue with that, but I wanted to ask you to think about this, because to abolish prisons doesn't simply mean to abolish the institutions or abolish the practices. It's about abolishing all of the practices that make prisons necessary and important, and it's about abolishing those practices that are encouraged by and reproduced by imprisonment. And violence against women is certainly at the top of the agenda. So to abolish the prison industrial complex would mean also to figure out how to purge our world against these horrendous modes of violence.
things that that we have in California and people have all over, of course, is cops in schools. And often armed police. And I don't know about here in and then they have what they call resource officers. And so, this is really horrendous and insidious, because the resource officers actually work for the schools as counselors and sometimes teachers. But they are also connected to the police department. So their first loyalty actually is to the police department. And so what has happened over the last period is that things that used to be considered normal in school. I know when I went to school, you know, kids were always cussing out the teachers. You know? Yeah. But now you can get arrested for that. Or getting into a scuffle with another student. Now you can get arrested for that, and you can actually get sent to juvenile hall. So the links that we're trying to make with the extent to which schools have come to follow in the footsteps of prisons, as a matter of fact, the prison is a model now for schools in communities of color, in poor communities of color. And in a sense, it's like finishing school for juvenile hall and then prison. And so I personally have been doing a lot of work with the juvenile hall facility that's 5 minutes away from my house. And I figured, you know, I cannot live in this neighborhood and not go in and talk to these kids periodically. So there is this wonderful program that's run by a librarian whose name is Amy Cheney. It's called Right to Read. And she brings in authors and has money to purchase the books of those authors for the kids who are in the program. So they all get a copy of the book. They read the book. Then the author comes in and gives a talk, and the kids get to engage with it.
That's beautiful.
And I've gone in several times. I said, okay, every time I publish a book, I'm going to go in. And it's so amazing because you see, talking to the boys, you see these kids who are, you know, supposed to be gang members, and they're supposed to have committed all of these violent things, and they're just so wonderful in the conversation. And every time I go, at the very end, they all want to come up and give me a hug. Every single one of them. I mean, it was just, and I mean, you can see there's so much promise there. And the fact is that these kids never had the opportunity to engage in that kind of conversation before. Education in the prisons, but also education instead of incarceration. We have to transform the very character of education. Because education for poor people, for poor black, Latinos, in poor white communities, has actually become a question of discipline and not of education. And education has always been important to producing the capacity to imagine the future. One cannot imagine the future without being educated. And I'm not talking about school education, because some people who never have gone to schools are far more educated than others. But what I am saying is that the very nature of how education is addressed in our schools has to be changed. Teachers have to stop assuming that their main job is to discipline the kids, but rather it's about teaching kids how to imagine the future.
I did.
Yes, I did. Now all I have in my pocket, Lord have mercy, all I can give a count of is a nickel and a nail. I want to say it one more time.
Combination of patience and
passion and fervor. Because if we do not do this work, it will not only be the case that we ourselves will never benefit, but coming generations may never get to imagine the possibility of inhabiting a world without violence.
On this week's episode of Education Justice Radio, we listen to Professor Davis talk Abolishing the Prison Industrial Complex about issues of mass imprisonment, prison abolitionism, and social justice. We also listen to her responses given at a breakfast meeting at the Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana. We would like to thank our EJP students at Danville Correctional Center for their valuable critical feedback. Education Justice Radio is a program of the Education Justice Project, and our mission is to provide a forum for expression and discussion about educational and incarceral issues. We invite your comments, suggestions, and volunteer support. Write us at educationjusticeradio@educationjustice.net.
And she got involved in the campaign for the election of Nelson, the first campaign for the election of Nelson Mandela. And she was going into Soweto, and these kids saw her. And, you know, to them, she was a white girl. She represented apartheid or whatever. Anyway, she was stoned to death, the most horrible kind of death. But to make a really long, complicated story short, the mother and father became involved with a couple of the boys who killed her through the Truth and Reconciliation. And one of them especially became one of the leaders of the Amy Gill Foundation. And so the thing that the mother said was that, "I learned to look into his eyes and see them as the last eyes that saw my daughter alive. And I learned to embrace him. I learned to love him." So that, I mean, to me, that is the most incredible kind of story. And I like to use it because it's a promise.
feel just fine.